What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
David Foshier is the founder of Cambriel Capital. In this conversation, we discuss why he chose to create a fund of funds. We talk about why he's so interested in the intersection of DeFi, generalized mining, quant, and VC. Where the current investment opportunities are for professional LPs, and some of the bad things that he's seen people do already. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I am here with David. Super excited to talk to you today. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Awesome. Before we get into what you guys are doing on the fund-to-fund side and some of the nuances there, maybe just give us a little bit of an update on your background.
Yeah, sure. So I went to uni, did a history degree, which was sort of an excuse to do a bit of everything. Did a lot of economic history. Through that, sort of got quite deep into the Austrian economics type stuff. And then I went and worked in tech. And while I was there, someone sent me the Bitcoin white paper in late 2012. And it was sort of this wonderful coming together of fintech and money and the history of money and how all of that came together. And so sort of fell down the rabbit hole very, very slowly, but persistently from 2013 onwards. And then sort of a long series of coincidences came together and we had the opportunity to do to look at doing a fund of funds for the crypto space and exploring whether that would be a good idea. And we took the plunge there about a year and a half ago. And I have sort of a family background in finance. And so through that, I'd met with a lot of hedge funds. And I was also meeting crypto funds and sort of comparing the two and couldn't get away from the feeling that there were some very sophisticated players in the traditional hedge fund space, and that there was sort of this disconnect between what we were seeing in crypto world in terms of fund management and some of the smarts and intellect and sophistication and operational kind of institutionalization that we'd seen in the traditional market. And it always felt like crypto was this long-term opportunity and that there was always going to be a lot of different strategies possible within it as an asset class. And it just always intuitively made sense to explore the fund of funds route, where you can just go and pick managers that make sense rather than specializing in a single strategy.
Got it. And so how do you think about the relationship between your investors into the fund of funds and then your relationship with those that you're invested in? Right? Because you kind of have this unique thing where you have investors, but then you take the seat of LP with the funds that you invest in.
Yes. So I guess the first thing, or the sort of key for us there has been extremely clear about why we're putting together our fund and what we're looking to achieve with it and make sure that we're aligned with our LPs. And fundamentally, you know, you pay fees on fees with a fund of funds. And you're paying for one of two things. The first is selection. And so somebody is paying us fees on top of the underlying funds fees to basically go out and find and analyze and select funds for them and do that work for them. And the other thing you can get paid for is access. And typically what you see with new asset classes that get financialized is you have this sort of first life cycle of fund of funds in which the fund of funds get paid for this diligence and selection that they're doing. And then over time, as the winners become apparent and those funds close, you're buying into a fund of funds and paying for the fees really for the access. And where we are today is sort of firmly at the very beginning of the selection. And so on the one hand, we have LPs that are sort of giving us money and basically saying, you know, please go out and allocate this intelligently for us and do the diligence and meet with the funds and do a selection. And then as we meet with underlying funds, I think the big negative is we may like a manager, but if we get redemptions, then we have to redeem from that manager. And so it's sort of like a pension fund or an insurance company or something like this, where the pot of capital we have is not permanent and is in some respects out of our control. And so what's important for us is to be very coherent between what our investors are asking of us and what we're investing into.
Got it. It makes a ton of sense. And then what I want to spend most of the time talking about today is, you know, there's kind of two buckets in my mind, right? There's the continuation of investing strategies that we've seen in other markets. So these are things like hedge funds or things like venture capital, right? They're kind of very traditional. They're well understood by both investors who are executing those strategies, but also by LPs. And then there are a bucket of new strategies. And so these are things around, you know, decentralized finance or DeFi, generalized mining, et cetera. And so maybe just talk about how you see the landscape to start, and then we can dig into those a little bit deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first place to start is that crypto is a new asset class, and it's unlike any that we've really seen before. In one specific respect, it's early stage tech and therefore very volatile. And at the same time, it's also liquid. And so you can imagine that sort of sits, you know, in the middle of your imaginary whiteboard. And to the left of that, you've got, you know, people that look at crypto and say, I don't care that it's liquid. This is early stage tech, and early stage tech is best done out of a venture fund. So I'm going to launch a venture fund, and I'm going to invest in, you know, early stage projects, you know, in seed and pre-seed investments. The issue there is that you've got a 10-year lockup fund, and by year four, all of your investments are going to be liquid. And so you might find yourself in a with a VC fund that's holding a portfolio of publicly traded assets, and the investment period, for example, may not be up. And so you're still sort of held to be relatively actively managing that portfolio. And that requires you as a VC to suddenly have and develop a bunch of new skill sets. It's not just when do I buy, it's when do I buy, but also when do I sell? And what do I do with the portfolio in the meantime? And you have to think about, even if you don't do it, you have to think about questions like portfolio management, liquidity, position sizing, hedging, when to sell. There's all of these new questions and considerations and operational questions and infrastructure that you need in order to be managing this liquid portfolio. And then on the other side of the fence, you've got people that look at crypto and say, I don't really care if it's early stage tech or not. This is liquid. And if it's liquid, it should be done out of a hedge fund. And so you've got guys who, on the other side of the fence, are launching a hedge fund structure in which when they make an equity or a SAFT investment, they're just putting that in a side pocket. So they're systematically using these side pockets in order to, you know, make sure that they have a correct, you know, asset and liability match. And I don't think either the VCs or the hedge funds are right or wrong. I think they're both right and wrong in different ways. But my intuition is that over time, we're going to see hybrid structures emerge that are much more adapted to crypto. And we've seen Paradigm sort of experiment with this. The guys coming out of Lightspeed are doing the same. And I think we'll continue over the next few years to have managers really trying to figure out what the right structure is. And that gets a whole lot more complicated when you're not just thinking about, you know, very simply buying tokens, but you're thinking about moving into some of these more frontier strategies around generalized mining and layer two, where suddenly, for example, you start asking questions like, how can I capture value at layer two if there's no company and there's no token? So for example, if I believe that Lightning is going to be, you know, the new sliced bread, how do we capture value there? How do we capture economics? And so probably the answer is moving towards actually direct participation. And so you have this new crop of funds, which you can sort of loosely label generalized mining funds, that are trying to figure out how you, what are the new and different ways that you can capture value directly in crypto networks when there isn't an equity or equity-like instrument available to buy? And that's, so, I think, really going to be fascinating.
Let's go back for a second and just describe what you mean by generalized mining, and then we can get into how you're seeing some of these strategies that people are attempting.
absolutely. So the idea behind generalized mining is often sort of considered to be about the same as staking. And so we, you know, the very first crypto networks we had were like Bitcoin in that the consensus mechanism was called proof of work. And the idea was, you know, I burn computations and make computers, you know, perform meaningless calculations, and that's my security model. And we've been moving towards a system called proof of stake, where the consensus model and the security model is built around the staking of assets. And generalized mining has sort of been considered to be the same as staking. And what we actually, we sort of define generalized mining a little bit differently as, yes, it's staking, but really it's how do I participate directly in networks, in crypto networks, and affect transactions or put capital at risk in order to try and generate a profit. And one way to do that is by staking tokens on the network. But there's a host of other ways. And this is the sort of everything except for staking is where we really see the interesting stuff from a funds perspective. And we wrote a big piece about this in November and did a big event during DevCon in Prague around generalized mining, just bringing together the stakeholders. And the stuff that we find interesting is, you know, this idea of interacting directly with a blockchain to somehow make money. And so the classic examples of this have been, you know, provisioning a network, so providing a service on a network in exchange for fees. So we saw that, you know, spinning up a node and running the node and provisioning a service, but also it's interacting with CDP contracts on the Maker network. And so Maker is a stablecoin system whereby they have a smart contract which you can collateralize, and it's called a CDP or collateralized debt position. And as you collateralize it, it will spit out a stablecoin at you called DAI. And so that allows you to do a number of things. One of them is to have an asset-backed stablecoin. Another is that effectively you can leverage up your positions in Ether because the collateral is ETH. And so you can put ETH into a smart contract, it spits out DAI, and then you use the DAI to buy more ETH. And so you can bring up, you know, your leverage to, for example, 1.5 on ETH. And what we have there is a set of game theoretic equilibriums that need to be reached for the stablecoin to retain its peg and to incentivize the network or the participants in the network to maintain the collateralization of the system itself. And the way in which that's expressed is that you have these things called network keepers, and they are doing stuff like monitoring every single CDP, and if it becomes under-collateralized, liquidating it and basically preserving the collateralization of the system as a whole. So it's the equivalent of margin calling. But you have these network incentives that allow anybody to come and do this. It's permissionless. And so you can go today and you can monitor CDP contracts, and if you're the first one to liquidate it, or bite it, as it's known, then you can actually collect, I think, a 12% reward for doing so. And so what you do is you post DAI to the contract, and it will spit the collateral back out at you, and then it's your job to go and liquidate it, and then you get a reward on top. And so what Maker has done as a crypto network is actually incentivized market participants in a trustless way to help the network maintain an equilibrium and a collateralization. And that's just one example of different ways in which crypto networks are starting to incentivize people to do things like maintain collateralization, liquidate, market make, arbitrage, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a whole host of opportunities in this generalized mining / DeFi space, which are opening up.
Got it. And so as you're seeing this, like, where are we in terms of being able to prove out that this stuff works, right? Like if you had to think of market cycles almost, are we still in the like very exploratory phase? Do you feel like we've kind of passed through that and we now, okay, like this works, and now how do we scale? Where are we?
So it sort of depends who you're speaking to. If you're speaking to more kind of traditional LPs, you know, crypto itself is a frontier. And so I would describe this as the frontier of the frontier. But if you're sort of, you know, chatting to crypto people who understand this, it's somewhat old hat. Like, it's been around for, you know, Maker has been around for a year. These ideas have been around for longer. And I think we're sort of in a phase at a fundamental level where things are starting to be proved out, roughly the systems work, but they're not very good. And so, you know, for example, Maker is going through some troubles at the moment. And so they've been reacting very aggressively by raising the DAI savings rate to 19%, which is sort of crazy, you would think. Clearly, the collateral mechanism they have, the pegging mechanism they have, are sort of not optimal. And so I think we're in a phase where roughly some of these systems have been shown to work. There are clearly a lot of issues to iron out, and that's to be expected, has been expected, and the issues are being ironed out. And it's probably another, you know, year to 2 years before we start seeing the simple applications really working better and therefore being able to scale. So I think we're in a period of experimentation and evolution on all of these crypto networks in the DeFi space. And we've come leaps and bounds, I think, since basically John Pfeffer's paper, which came out in, I believe, November, December 2017, which said utility tokens are going to go to zero, basically because there's no reason to hold them for any significant period of time. And that, as far as I can tell, really kicked off a long period of reflection and work in the crypto community, where we brought together economics and game theory with, you know, actual crypto. And token engineering, or how you design tokens and networks, I think has become much more sophisticated and nuanced. And we're now starting to get to a point where people are, I think, very mature in their thinking as to how you might design a system that appropriately incentivizes multiple participants and does so to achieve an equilibrium that's sort of valuable for everyone. So we're experimenting, getting better, but maybe not ready for prime time.
Got it. And so I guess that part of this is really, we're seeing new strategies come to fruition. We're seeing investor interest in those strategies, right? And I categorize that as both individual investors. So we do see, you know, retail investors doing CDPs and things like that, for example, mm-hmm. but also LP interest in kind of more concise and organized funds structures. One of the things I keep going back to here, though, is just how much money can be put to work, right? So it's great that the strategies are forming, but if you're a retail investor, you never really think about capacity of investment, right? When you're an LP, especially from a fund-to-fund standpoint, you think about that a lot, right? And so are we still in a stage where, I don't know, $20, $30, $40 million funds? Or do we have the potential to see in, let's say, generalized mining or DeFi, kind of the hundreds of millions of dollars in size, or maybe even a billion-plus dollar fund?
Yeah, so definitely not big. There's a guy called Alex, who I work with on our team. And Alex has been doing exactly this deep dive into what are the kind of market neutral DeFi type strategies that are investable today, and how much capacity is there, and is it a good idea, and what are the returns like, and all of this. And so it's a piece that we need to write up and should be published in the next month or two. But the conclusions that we've gotten to so far there, which are not conclusive, is that there are opportunities. There's, you know, four or five different identifiable opportunities or trades or strategies that you could put on. That these are limited to anywhere between 50,000 and 500,000 each. And so there is a small cottage industry of extremely forward-thinking funds that are mostly, you know, deploying their own proprietary capital, but looking to raise more when the volumes go up, who are doing some very interesting trades at the moment in this DeFi space. I think they're finding it very, very hard to raise because almost nobody understands what they do. And finding LPs with that level of sophistication is really difficult. And mm-hmm. so it's almost like they can't raise much more than they have, but at the same time, they couldn't deploy it anyway. And for us, the way we view it is it's intellectually fascinating. If crypto networks develop the way we think they will, then there are going to be more and more of these opportunities. And over the longer term, they're going to get bigger and bigger in terms of capacity. And that it's sort of almost our duty to have done the work on this, because if we as a fund of crypto funds only don't have a view on this, then who does? It's like, surely we should. This is sort of what we're set up to do, the kind of work we're set up to do. It's old school quant meets deep tech, crypto networks, and smart contract auditing, and all of these fun things. My intuition is that this is pretty uninvestable right now, but a year from now, things could change dramatically.
For sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about where you think the first kind of professional LP capital, right? So fund of funds or large institutional investors like endowments, pensions, foundations, sovereign wealth, et cetera. Where in the DeFi or generalized mining space do you think that money can flow into first?
In terms of LPs investing in funds, or where in the DeFi space can money flow to?
Going into funds first.
Yeah. So into funds, well, actually, I should give a shout out to Dan Zuller at Vision Hill, who I think has been on your podcast.
Yep.
But
yes.
I imagine we're not allowed to say who, but they invested in a very forward-thinking fund that's been doing some of the best work on generalized mining that we've been able to find, and who have, a complicated pitch, because what they're doing is complicated and forward-thinking. And it's really wonderful from our perspective to see somebody go out and actually allocate other people's money to that. I think it will probably work out to be a great investment for them. It's just more difficult to do. And so I have a huge amount of respect for people that on the fund of funds side go out and do the work and underwrite it correctly and then allocate to more forward-thinking strategies and aren't scared to do so. But I think the bulk of the capital there is going to come from early crypto investors who are probably allocators as a profession. So it's all of those single family offices in the US that have been allocating to crypto for 2, 3, 4 years, that were some of the early investors in Polychain, and who are now sort of looking at what's the next wave and are happy to invest right at the frontier. I think that's probably where the first 10, 20 million for these funds is going to come from. And I think the institutions are starting to, you know, some institutional players are starting to get comfortable with crypto, and they're probably doing it via sort of traditional venture. And that if you came to them with a pure kind of generalized mining fund pitch, it might be quite scary. And also they'd probably not be very interested because they can only deploy a very small amount of capital into it.
Got it. And so let's talk about the diligence side of this, right? Obviously, when you have things that are new and cutting edge, they look different. They might be harder to wrap your head around. Maybe let's talk about how you guys go through the due diligence process, and then we can talk about some of the bad stuff that you've seen.
Sure. So we can't talk too much about our own process, but I would suggest that there are certain things that all investors should look for. And for us, sort of one of the most important things is to establish, you know, prima facie going in is, can we get deeply comfortable with the integrity of the manager and the way in which they think about stewarding capital and aligning with LPs on a liquidity perspective, on a fees perspective, on skin in the game in terms of investing alongside them? And I think that's very much sort of a nice first hurdle to look at. And as a, if you're a non-crypto investor, this is one that is shared by every investment you'll ever have made in the past. And so it's the same sort of process. The next sort of thing I would suggest is trying to find a manager that whatever strategy they're pursuing, that they are genuinely sort of world-class at it, that they really have a fluency and an understanding of the strategy that they're doing. That's world-class, that's unparalleled. And the luxury that we have is being able to really not or be able to focus on finding managers who are extremely specialized in what they do rather than doing a little bit of everything. And so the only way to really do that is to go out and talk to 100 funds. And I know it takes a lot of time, but if you really want to understand how one fund stacks up against the rest of the landscape, which they're going to be competing against, there's not really any other way to do it than to just to go out and talk to everyone. And that takes a lot of time and commitment, and it's you can't really get around that. I think then you can sort of move on to, and strategies really differ, so it's difficult to unless we wanted to go down on one particular strategy, it's difficult to go through the kind of things you'd look for. But then on the, there's a, I think a real lack of operational due diligence that's being done on funds at the moment. It's very, very surface level. And so what does the counterparty credit risk for your fund look like? So you invest in a fund and that fund then goes and trades on exchanges. How much of their capital is on an exchange at any one time or with a different counterparty? And of the exchanges that they're trading on, you know, there are exchanges that you'd prefer your capital to be with and exchanges you'd rather not. So a dollar on Coinbase is probably not going to be the same as a dollar on a random dodgy exchange you've never heard of in a, you know, that's regulated in Vanuatu. So it's, there's a lot of sort of work to be done on the operational side around the risks that a fund is taking on there, because the returns might look great, but they might have a lot of tail risk embedded in the strategy. And so you really want to get comfortable around things like counterparty credit, around the infrastructure they've built, around trading infrastructure, market risk management, potentially around custody. It's not normal for the fund manager to control the fund's assets themselves. It's not normal that you can walk away with your fund's crypto and just buy a boat and go on an early retirement. And it's in a traditional fund that would never happen. And there's a third party fiduciary, typically the administrator, who's involved in the process of actually moving assets around. And so in crypto, we've started to finally have custody providers and people that can provide sort of a walled garden within which the manager is able to move funds from the bank account onto the exchanges, trade on exchanges, move assets between the exchanges and back to the bank account, but they can't withdraw it to their own or an arbitrary crypto address. And that the importance of that, I don't think can be understated, because it's not just that you should be pursuing a zero trust setup, because that's just the right thing to do. It's that this isn't actually an academic question. We've come across two funds where guys just walked into the office with, in one case, guns, and in the other case, baseball bats. And they said, give me the crypto. And so it's as much about protecting yourself and your investors as demonstrating that you're a proper fiduciary. And then there's a whole sort of analysis around the quality of the returns, because a lot of crypto funds are charging very high fees. A lot of them are posting very high returns, but you need to be able to separate out or tease out the quality of those returns and how much beta versus alpha you're actually paying for. So those are maybe some kind of starting points.
Got it. And so as you have done diligence now on a number of these funds, what's some of the like bad behavior, right? Don't say who it is, but just when you look at things that either don't meet the standard or would even be considered nefarious, like what are the things that you've seen and people should look out for?
So yeah, criticized by category and praised by name.
Exactly.
The two most egregious things that I've seen that come to mind, this was a while ago. We've really had some very bad actors, I think, that were launching funds in 2016-17. One of them was doing arbitrage and posting great returns and crowing about, you know, how wonderfully they were doing. And when we really dug in, the way in which they were getting the spreads was that, so they had, you know, a serious setup. They had a real fund with a real auditor and administrator and real bank and all of this. And so prima facie, you would think they're doing things sort of by the book. But we sort of dug in and what they were doing was they were actually arbitraging like random Indian and African exchanges with very, very little volume where, yes, the prices swung wildly from anything else. And it turned out that their administrator wasn't allowing them to do this out of the fund. They just wouldn't allow it. And so what these guys had done, instead of saying, you're right, we probably shouldn't be doing something like that, that's too risky, they actually did a swap with a proprietary vehicle. And so what they basically did is they sent investor cash from the fund into the vehicle. The vehicle sent back a little credit note or receipt saying, you know, thanks for your $1 million. We owe you $1 million. And then out of this proprietary vehicle, which is sort of a black box, they were going and doing all of the stuff that they weren't allowed to do out of the main fund and then posting the profits back. And that's just, we have a very strong aversion to that, because until you actually do the digging unless you know what to ask, you don't really see that. And it's not like they're coming straight up and telling you about it. You've really got to dig. And so I think that there will have been a lot of investors that put money into that without knowing. And there are equivalents today, especially on the arbitrage side, with people getting around capital restrictions, because that's really the only place where you have big spreads in this sort of like trivial inter-exchange job. So that's one. We saw another fund that this was way back when, but they were, you know, they were very proud of and really telling us again and again how wonderfully safe and audited they were, because they had one of the big four auditors that was auditing them, which at the time didn't exist. And so we dug into that because it seemed weird, because we'd just spoken to the auditor and that auditor had said we would never do crypto, which obviously they now do. And so what they had was that they had a first fund and then a second fund. And the first fund was really just a feeder into the master vehicle. And that feeder was audited by the big four auditor. And the second vehicle was audited by someone we'd never heard of. And it's just little things like this that we think set a bad precedent. There was a whole host of funds during 2017 that I care less about, because I think they made stupid mistakes. They looked at the volumes that were being traded and didn't worry that those volumes might go down. And so they were happy having a quarterly liquidity vehicle holding these crypto assets. Obviously, what happened in 2018 is that the liquidity dried up and they had to gate their fund. And a lot of investors were unhappy. But I think most of the time with those funds, the reason why they were doing it was out of ignorance. And it's not good and you shouldn't have invested, but at least it wasn't malicious. And I think in the first two examples I gave, it's sort of willful. There's an element of willfulness to it that there wasn't in some of the funds in 2017-18. But there's all sorts of stuff. I sit on the board of the advisory board of a company called GDF, Global Digital Finance, which is a self-regulatory organization in London, which is trying to basically set out a code of conduct and standards for the different kind of financial participants in crypto. And the way I got in touch with them is I got an email from them saying, you know, could you tell us a few of the bad or egregious things that you have seen in the markets? Because we're writing a code of conduct for funds. And I started writing and it ended up being 7 pages long. And there's a ton of, or has been a ton of bad stuff happen in the space, but a lot of it has been cleaned up. And a lot of the funds that have survived the downdraft are actually much higher quality.
And so I guess in all of this, out of the things that you see that kind of disqualify a fund from investment from you guys or other professional LPs, how much of it is ignorance and versus like negligence, right? Like if they just don't know better versus they're actually doing something that is hurting what they're doing and may even be nefarious activity.
So our area of focus is market neutral strategies. So we're looking at, you know, structural arbitrage, market making, liquidity provision, OTC, quant, predictive models, trend following, all of this kind of stuff. And all of these strategies have in common, apart from the return characteristics, is that they are much more sophisticated than just buying crypto assets that you like and holding them. And, you know, the advantage of that is that the market goes up, the market goes down, you still make money. You'll typically make money when there's volatility and not make much money when there's no volatility, but there's not really a correlation to the market. The corollary to that is that the types of managers that are running those strategies are also much more sophisticated. And so the prototypical manager that we are speaking to has managed capital before in a hedge fund and typically is coming out of one of the big quant shops or hedge funds and is just applying the same strategies or porting over the same strategies they were running in fixed income or options markets or commodities or futures. And they're just porting those over into crypto. And for them, it's the same discipline, the same structures, the same trades, the same mentality, but ported over into a new market. And so the answer I'm going to give you is a bit biased in that typically if we're passing on a fund, it'll be because they're mediocre rather than they're terrible, because there aren't really any terrible players that, you know, wake up one morning and say, we should totally do a sophisticated market neutral strategy. And so it's usually because we found something better, and they're usually not ill-willed. I think it's much the same as the traditional hedge fund world. You don't have cowboys coming out and wanting to do these types of strategies.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense to me. Okay. And then where do you think we go from here, right? So as you kind of look out and say, hey, over the next 3 to 5 years, what are you excited about and think people should be paying attention to?
So we've spoken to about 150 crypto funds so far, roughly. The interesting opportunities in our eyes from an LP's perspective are sort of at the two ends of the barbell. And so on the one side, it's these sort of market neutral opportunities. And what you're saying there is, you know, there's an inefficient market. I don't need to take a directional view on crypto, and I can make money from the inefficiency in a strategy that's very liquid. And so you make some money every day. And if the opportunity disappears, you just go to cash and you can hand the money back to investors and that's done. And so that's really one thing. And that's just pure sort of alpha capture in this market. And the other, I think, interesting opportunity here as an LP is the opposite end of things, which is the venture side of the stuff, which is to say that there is a reasonable investment case over the next 20 years for crypto and crypto networks, that these networks are probably going to proliferate, that there will probably be a token attached, that there are some sort of areas of crypto where you can say it's reasonable that this product or service or network should exist, and where you can go out and build like a probability adjusted basket of what you think are going to be the likely winners and then hold on to those for 10 years. And so, you know, there are definitely use cases for zero knowledge proof technology. It sort of makes sense that we should have a smart contract platform in the world. Distributed file storage, governance, there's all these sort of, you know, the money use case. What does programmatic money look like? And is it inherently useful? There's all these sort of sub-theses within crypto where you can look at them and say, well, there's a reasonable case to be made that this should exist. And probably some of the leading protocols or the key pieces of infrastructure are going to get lame in the next 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 years. And so can we get exposure to that? And can we get exposure in such a way that we're allocating to somebody who deeply understands the market that they're investing in and is never going to be made a forced seller? And so what that looks like for us is investing in deeply technical venture capital structures. So the managers being deeply technical, deeply embedded in the crypto ecosystem, thinking very deeply around where value will be created and how it is best captured. And then going to those places and investing in those places out of a vehicle that has a long lockup in which, you know, their investors on a whim can't just make them into a forced seller and crash the fund. So we really see opportunity at the two ends of the spectrum. And then you can overlay on that the generalized mining and DeFi stuff that we've been talking about, which for the moment I think is probably a portion of a fund rather than a standalone strategy. But that's changing sort of month by month. And I think we will see funds like that over the next couple of years emerging. Some of them have, but not just emerging, but actually raising and succeeding.
Got it. And so before I finish up, I always do a rapid fire set of questions. I'm super interested in your answers. What do you think is the most important company or fund in crypto today?
I'm going to have to go with I think Coinbase, which is probably an answer that many people would give. But I think they are perfectly placed in terms of brand, reputation, user base, and their position in the market to guide and nudge the direction of crypto into the more sort of serious territory, and to be able to introduce some of these more sort of, you know, quote unquote crazy concepts around DeFi, generalized mining, etc. All of the frontier is something that they really understand and that I think they can bring to regulators and governments and users who are less sophisticated, in a way that's sort of measured and controlled and understandable and explained. I think they're a good sort of conduit for education and experimentation, a good sort of middleman between these two worlds.
Got it. I think that that is a very fair way to look at it. It's also, I like to think about there's the most important crypto companies inside the US, and then there's the most important crypto companies globally, right? And the answer probably changes. But I think Coinbase is a good answer. What's the one regulation you would change or improve if you could?
This is a little bit broad, but we've been trying to pigeonhole crypto assets into specific buckets. And the problem is that the actual token economic models have been extremely diverse and are changing all the time. And so crypto doesn't really fit well in a regulatory bucket. And I would love to see more coordination between regulators within a country. So between, for the US, the SEC, the CFTC, and the IRS, because all of those players are required to sort of have a coordinated and coherent response and position. And for them to, I think, more deeply understand the different types of tokens that we can have. And I think separating out, for example, a utility token as not a security would be an enormous step towards its adoption and usage.
Yeah, so it's more just getting clarity, right?
If the clarity is we're going to treat everything as a security, then that really dampens the ability to create and use these assets.
Yeah, I guess my pushback to people, right, is the way I understand it, I could be wrong, it is not the way that the asset is used is what makes it a security. It is that they are used for fundraising, right? So if people basically created, whatever token and did not solicit funds from people in exchange for those tokens, that would reduce, a very high percentage of the regulatory risk. Now, I understand why they do it, but I think that you've got to separate out the fundraising component of it from the usage, because I agree with you that the usage is pretty clear, right? I haven't seen many, if any at all, of these utility tokens that are a security in the usage of them. It's always around the fundraising and where
the issuance of them.
Yeah.
So I'm completely in agreement with, because I think what we saw with ICOs was really sad to see. It sucks to be in the same industry as people like that. But in the UK, if I send any crypto, Bitcoin or whatever it is, to anyone else, it's treated as property from a tax perspective. So if I were to pay for my coffee in Bitcoin, I need to compute the capital gains that I made on that transaction and log that for next year's tax return with HMRC.
For sure. What
it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, what do you think your most controversial thought in crypto is? What do you believe that a high majority of other people disagree with?
I hope Bitcoin goes back down from here and that we don't have any more money into the space, which I realize is not at all what we should be saying if we're trying to raise money. But I think we're in a very interesting Goldilocks period right now where there is enough capital if you're a world-class project that you can actually raise money and pay your team and build. And I think that the next wave of a bull run, if it were to come, should come from usage. And that we've made leaps and bounds since early 2018, but not enough for there to be any usage. And I think it would be wonderful to see people working heads down for longer, actually maturing these protocols, more product people coming in, making them more usable, more scalable, etc. And then that being the sustainable basis for a move in prices. But I think what we're seeing now is over the last few months has just been, a lot of money flowing into Bitcoin and money has then flowed out of Bitcoin into other assets. But fundamentally, nothing has changed since last year. And so it would be great to see a period of moderation in crypto.
I think that's it's counterintuitive to most, but I think that makes sense. What's the most important book you've ever read?
Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb.
Why?
It's this idea of, so he has this sort of mental model of saying, a champagne glass is fragile. You know, any sort of shock or perturbation and it shatters. You can build more robust things. So instead of a champagne glass, build a champagne glass out of concrete. You make it more robust. And what he introduces is this concept of anti-fragility, which is things that benefit from volatility. And so if you actually look at, human bodies and the immune system, we benefit from some volatility, some stress. And so if you have a kid that doesn't go out and play in the mud and catch, random bugs, their immune system doesn't get any stronger. And they'll one day just get a common cold and just fall dead. And so it's this idea that you have systems in the world, especially in biology, that are made stronger by volatility. And I think it was one of the most interesting ideas I ever came across and has a lot of applications, I think, as a lens through which to view things. And how can we build anti-fragility into our products and our funds and our investment strategies and our lives?
It's one of the best for a reason, right? Aliens, believer, non-believer?
Believer, because probably I don't know too much about it, but if the universe is infinite and there are infinite permutations, then surely there must be life. But I would bet that it looks like totally different to anything we would conceive of. So like talking like gaseous life forms or something. It's not going to be little green men, but there's something.
Yeah. Do you think that we'll actually come across aliens in our lifetime?
I don't know. I would ask Tim Urban. I feel like he will have thought about this. The guy who wrote Ready But Why.
If somebody's thought about it, it is probably him and Elon Musk.
Yeah.
All right. All right, man. What one question you have for me?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you what you thought the most interesting company in crypto was, the most important.
So I will answer as the most important company in crypto. I've said for a while, I think it's Facebook. And the reason is just the best technology doesn't always win. It is all about distribution and mind share and adoption. And whether we like it or not, when Facebook launches, they are going to have the largest user base in all of crypto on day one, right? They're going to be able to launch the thing to hundreds of millions of people. And so that isn't necessarily a guarantee that they will be successful, but I do think that it's really important that they launch or to pay attention to what they launch because they're going to have the largest user base, immediately. And so to me, it's just go where the numbers are and they've got the numbers.
So distribution is important, but I'm always skeptical of companies launching something and competing in a market where this is going to be, priority number 10 or 12 or 57 for them. And it's sort of like when Amazon comes into X market, everyone gets very worried or intrigued, but actually they don't end up doing anything because they're focused on so many other things that it ends up sort of falling through the cracks. I wouldn't put that against Mark Zuckerberg. So we'll see.
That is definitely a potential, kind of downside. I think the thing that I would say back to it is there's an argument to be made, and one that I would make, where Facebook is going to completely shift their business model. So they are going to try to move to a world where it is not based on advertising, but instead it is based on financial services. And so if that is true, then this becomes their number one priority. Right, so I think that we can agree, if it is not a priority, odds of success are low. If it is a priority, actually they might have a better shot, right?
Man, so if they pull that off, they deserve to kill it.
Yeah.
That would be an extraordinary pivot.
Yeah, exactly. So look, it would go down as one of the most incredible, insane, pivots of all time, but look, if somebody's going to do it, it's probably them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I like it.
So we'll see. But all right, listen, I really enjoyed this. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
to share your thoughts here. And we'll have to do it again in a little while to get an update on how things are going.
With pleasure.
Hey everyone, Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.